Asking from Nashville, Tennessee. This is Keep Asking, the weekly podcast that helps you dive in a bit deeper and wider into the research providing insights into today's church and culture. Hello and welcome. I'm Lizette Beard here with Scott McConnell and Casey Oliver. Today we're going to be talking about some new data we have from American Pastors about church finances. But before we jump into that, I have a super serious question for both of you. Here's the scenario. You've each been bequeathed $785,000 by a distant relative with strict instructions. One, the money cannot be invested, nor can any of it be donated to a nonprofit. Yet, the entire amount has to be spent within the next 18 months. What's your plan?
Wow. You took away the first two uses that I normally would think of.
We've met.
Because, yeah, my first reaction is try to make it last as long as possible. So we've got to spend it how fast?
In 18 months, which I think is actually, I remember hearing from a financial planner. I don't have the official results on this, but a lawyer who was talking that said that's regardless of the amount, inheritances are typically blown in 18 months.
Wow. I was kind of thrown off by several of the specificity of some of it with the $785,000.
Well, I started out with $5 million and I thought, I don't even know if I could blow through $5 million in 18 months.
How did you land on?
I just started getting really specific. Okay, yeah. Stop with the chit-chat. I need to know. I wanted to get to the fun. Like if you weren't going to feel guilty by not giving it to the church and not investing it, what kind of fun could you have for $785,000?
I don't know. I could travel for 18 months. So a little leave of absence and, you know, hey, kids, let's homeschool the next 18 months and hit the road. That would be a fun way to do it. And obviously you can go first class with that kind of money. But
I mean, my first reaction was that I would just not have, I would eliminate most of the responsibilities that I have. So anything, you know, we'd probably get, you know, a nanny and not like we'll still hang out with our kids, but then they can
the first thing he thinks of is outsourcing the parenting.
Or like, you know, somebody to clean the house, like whatever, right. All those things so that, you know, I'm just doing the fun jobs around the house and none of the work jobs. That's probably what I would.
Well, I hope Scott and I get our windfall at the same time, because that's exactly what I would do, is I would travel. And I was even having trouble because I thought, oh, around the world cruise. But I'm like, I don't think that's going to take a big enough chunk out of it. So
you can always have a new house waiting for you when you get home. You
know? Right, yeah. Right. But I was just thinking, what are some really rich experiences? Maybe one of the thoughts I also had was with my mom being older, making sure she could travel in very high level of comfort, you know, and so, but get to see some of the places that she's wanted to see. All right. So enough about our good fortune and windfalls and finances. Let's talk about church finances. We asked pastors about their church's cash reserves, any experience with embezzlement and financial audits. Now, typically, if you're going to tell me we're going to talk about church finances, this would automatically bore me, and I'm just keeping it real, and I would just start to tune you guys out and just have some generic questions that whenever there was a pause. But these three topics stir a little stress in me, and maybe I should clarify, I do not have a guilty conscience on any of these. But is that what we were going for with this trio of questions? Some stressors?
Yeah, definitely. You know, some of this is more just kind of systemic, but some of it also can be kind of tragic if we're talking about embezzlement or something where somebody's misappropriated funds.
The responses to the question about cash reserves fascinates me. I was not expecting to see. Well, and I can let y'all maybe introduce that, but the smaller churches had a pretty strong response, more so than those with the larger churches. So, but I'll let you jump in and kind of start describing it.
Well, just at kind of at the top level, you know, 26% say their churches have cash reserves for 7 weeks or less, 24% 8 to 15 weeks, 15% 16 to 25, 12% 20, so half a year to a year basically, and 23% a year or more.
So it's really spread out, basically, yes. From, you know, less than 2 months all the way to 52 weeks.
Yeah, to have a quarter in both of those spaces of 7 weeks or less and a year or more. Again, and I'm not an expert on this, and it's one of those things where I didn't know what my expectation would be or what's even sort of best practice. And I'd kind of look to Scott to maybe tell us maybe more about that.
It's not an easy thing to answer. What is best? I mean, the rule of thumb for a lot of businesses is 3 to 6 months of reserves. And when we say reserves, and we had this ready in case a pastor needed an explanation, but essentially, if offerings stop tomorrow at your church, how long could you continue to pay your bills? And that would include your payroll. You know, both ends of the spectrum that Casey was pointing out are pretty amazing that, you know, that a quarter of churches wouldn't even make it 2 months, but that another almost a quarter could make it a year or more. They've got that much in the bank to continue to pay staff, to continue to pay a mortgage if they have one and the like. It does tend to differ by industry, how much reserves a business keeps. But a recent survey by JP Morgan Chase on small businesses, we find that the median small business has 27 days of cash reserves.
Whew.
So they couldn't last, you know, half of small businesses could not last a month without some income coming in. And, you know, obviously, you know, small businesses will often have debt, often be leveraged, and you know, payroll's a big chunk of their business, and so those are real things that affect your cash flow. But those characteristics can be characteristics of churches as well. Especially a younger church often has the debt of their building. One of the biggest expenses for every church, typically being at least 40% of their budget, is their payroll, and so those make you vulnerable to cash flow issues.
Casey, anything stand out to you on that one?
Again, it's one of those things where I didn't come in sort of saying like, oh, this is what it should be, and that's always interesting. I guess, you know, it's probably even a good example for people as they're processing research, you know, well, what was my expectation for this question? And is it different from that? And is that insightful? And sometimes maybe it's just a completely, you know, new area where, you know, it's helpful to hear what Scott was saying and just to be able to process, you know, how dire a situation is that or how different a situation is that from maybe broader culture and other industries.
You know, we do see that larger churches kind of avoid the lowest level, the lowest amount of time, and they tend to land in the 8 to 15 week category. 4 out of 10 mid to large size churches land in that amount of cash reserves. And, you know, they tend to be the ones that probably have somebody at least part-time on staff helping with finances and, you know, more likely to be a little more organized in that way. So I think for every ministry, we need to be surrounding ourselves with good financial minds so that we understand for how our ministry operates, what kind of cash flow is needed to make sure that we're ready for the unexpected. And that we don't have too much tied up so that we're burying our talents as the parable went, mm-hmm. that Jesus shared. We want to be using those resources to do ministry, but at the same time, we need to have enough in reserve that when something unexpected happens, ministry can continue.
All right. So 1 out of 10 pastors say that they have had someone embezzle funds from their current church. And just to clarify, kind of the boundaries of the question, the embezzling could have happened while the pastor has been at this current church or before the pastor arrived, correct? That was in there. And we defined embezzle for the participants as taking church money for personal use. So we're talking about a pretty broad spectrum of time when it could have happened in the history that the pastor would know about, and also the amount. You know, you could be talking about petty cash or, you know, a big financial discretion. I certainly hope we're not talking about a church employee being found with a significant number of binder clips from the church supply closet that ended up at their home, because if that qualifies as embezzlement, I may actually have a guilty conscience.
Or vanilla wafers from the nursery.
Yes, there you go. So what did we learn? Did we see anything here when you broke it out, Casey? Take your time.
Okay, thanks.
I'm teasing you.
So, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where when you, I feel like there was really a lot there in terms of distinctions, which actually might be telling in some ways that, you know, sort of across the spectrum, people were at least around that 10% range.
Okay.
That, you know, it isn't like, oh, you know, in big churches it's happening 30% of the time, and in small churches it's never happening. You know, I think that. It seems like it's pretty similar across the board.
Well, let me push on you a little bit there.
Okay.
You know, we've got a full page of what we call significant differences, and yet you're not seeing very much. Why is it that sometimes something can be statistically significant and yet it doesn't seem to matter?
Yeah, you know, statistically significant versus meaningful, you know, that... if you have a large enough sample size, sometimes you can say these two things that are 2% apart are statistically significant from one another. And sometimes with, you know, some of those Pew Research studies where they have, I don't know, 20,000 or whatever people come into it, sometimes you see things flagged as significantly different. You go like, well, that doesn't really seem like it matters at all, you know. But so when you're saying statistically significant, all you're really saying is we know that, well, we're, you know, more than 95% confident that these – that the numbers are different for the population as a whole. So not just in our sample, not just in the people we asked, but, you know, when we say, let me find one of the examples here. So when we say that pastors age 55 to 64, 12% of them are more likely to select yes than those 65 plus, 4% of those. That's enough. That 8% gap there is enough to say that among 55 to 64 year old pastors, that number is higher than it is. There's enough evidence to say that it's higher than it is for pastors age 65 plus. But still, for both of those, you know, that 12% number is not really very much different from the 9% overall. So I think it's one of those things where you'd say, okay, well, knowing that information tells me these groups are at least a little bit different, but we don't know. You know, it's not a slur. It's not an effect size. It's not saying here's how different they are. And sometimes those differences can be pretty small as opposed to gigantic.
So it's a real difference, but it's not enough to change the story.
Right.
Did we do any? And I know this is totally flying crazy here, but did you happen to look and see if those churches? In any crosstabs between those who've never had a financial audit at their church, jumping ahead to our third question, maybe they're not recognizing enough embezzlement because didn't look.
We haven't actually looked at that. That's actually worth looking at, though.
Yeah,
I feel like that was interesting. So,
yeah.
You know, sometimes we do that, a little bit of a deep dive where we say, you know, not just on demographics, but, you know, here's this other question that might relate to how they would answer this and kind of look at a different cut then.
So I'm going to go ahead and assign that to you.
Yep.
And then if there's anything super exciting, we'll put it in the show notes. But because it makes me think, and I'm jumping ahead here, in full disclosure, I've never been in charge of handling or managing the finances for a congregation. I realize that's stunning for everyone involved. But I'm stunned that 10% of pastors say that their church has never had a complete financial audit. Now, again, we didn't have an open end where they gave us the story or the reason. So it could be, you know, transparency. Everybody can see the books anytime they want. It could be we've never gotten around to it. We can't we don't have the expertise. So it could be any kind of indication, but I would be interested to see if that number changes. If my hunch would be those who've never had an audit might be less likely to report that they've ever had embezzlement because they're not looking at it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, even the way we asked that question on the embezzlement question, we basically gave the options as yes or not that I know of, because, you know, we're aware that just because we're not aware that somebody like Scott Sked took $100 from the petty cash doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It's just that, you know, sometimes people aren't aware of when that embezzlement happens. So,
and if we add in the pastors that weren't sure when the last time their church had a complete audit, I mean, that's a quarter of pastors. It's not in recent memory that their church had an audit. And, you know, obviously you're looking for indiscretions in an audit, but you're also making sure that, your accounting practices themselves are ethical. And, you know, I think as ministries, we're called to, to be above reproach. And that's true of leaders and it's true of ministries. And so I think as leaders, we've got to be leading our ministry to take those steps, whether it be in the set of ethics that relate to accounting or the set of ethics in how we communicate or other aspects of our ministry. And, we're definitely served by ministries like EFCA and others that have been coming alongside ministries and coming alongside churches and giving them guidance on how to make sure their practices and how they taxes and other accounting things, they can be above reproach.
What are, and you guys, I didn't tell you I was going to say this, but, or ask this, which is like many of my questions, but if a pastor or a ministry looks at this and realizes, oh, that's something we need to be doing, but they don't have any kind of orientation, you know, they're just sitting there with Quicken hanging on for dear life. Any suggestions or tips on?
You know, I think you've got to, well, I think you alluded to it earlier, Lizette, the fact that you've never been near this, you know, that's a matter of using people's skills and their spiritual gifts.
Right.
And so that, you know, finances isn't a spiritual gift, but it is, a gift that God gives certain people to handle finances. And even in a church of a dozen people, one of those dozen people is going to be better with finances than the others. And even that person, though, needs some accountability to mm-hmm. someone else. And that someone may need to be on the outside of that fellowship mm-hmm. to look over what they're doing.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Because hasn't it been... in some traditional churches, like the treasurer or the person who actually works in the church office is actually a member, you know, who handles the money is actually a member at a different church and goes on Sundays. Have you all seen that? That's actually a couple of churches I've gone to have actually had that. And it could be the sweetest little old lady who's just a fiend with the numbers, but, you know, she goes to the Presbyterian church down the street and it's just a little bit of that separation. So I'm not advocating, hey, cut out your member. I'm not saying good or bad, but it's that just having a choice of, hey, we're having someone here, but there's also making sure there's some relationship separation.
Well, and, you know, I think that's sort of a good word of advice in a lot of different areas, just to have layers of accountability and, you know, to, you know, maybe not for everyone they need that, but for some people that's a good step that they can take to, like Scott said, be above reproach. You know, thinking about that in other areas, even we asked in the pastor protection survey about having another staff member present when you're counseling members of the opposite sex, and 78% of pastors say that they do that. You know, that's just sort of another one of those steps, whether it's financial or whether it's in a different space, where you can say, how can I make sure I'm above reproach and make sure that I'm, you know, protecting and against risks potentially.
All right. good stuff, guys. Casey's going to dig in and spend the next couple of days just soaking up what other rich finds that we can have. But we'll see if we have anything else and add that to the show notes. Thanks for listening to Keep Asking, the Lifeway Research Podcast. If you like what you've just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, lifewayresearch.com, to colleagues or friends who may be interested. Rate and review us on iTunes, and be sure to tweet your questions and comments to us at Lifeway Research, and individually at S. McCon, at Stats Guy Casey, and at Lizette Beard. Join us next time for another edition of Keep Asking. Keep asking, learn more, do better.